You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Sunday, September 4th, although only barely, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Tara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella. Yeah. Evan Bernstein.
Hello.
And we have a special guest for this episode, Ian Harris.
Yes.
Ian, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide. Tell us a little bit about yourself to get us started.
Oh, sure. I'm a comedian and skeptic and a skeptic comedian. That's pretty much all I do.
You're a skeptic and a comedian at the same time.
Yes, I try to be. Sometimes I'm a comedian and sometimes I'm a skeptic and they don't laugh. and sometimes they laugh at me being skeptical. But no, I try to infuse skepticism and critical thinking into my comedy. That's my entire thing. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot to make fun of on the other side, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You probably wouldn't be surprised because you do this, but, the mainstream, because I do mainstream comedy, I've done it for almost 24 years. It's a touchy area to walk because no matter what you do, you kind of piss somebody off on every show. I don't care if it's religion or if it's, there's some belief they have that I find somebody that gets angry with me every show or that has to, have a discussion with me about, really Bigfoot. Okay, dude.
But then you know you're doing it correctly then.
Yeah, I hope so.
What's the worst thing that's happened to you?
Yeah, I had, I had a lady, I've had a lot of weird things happen to me, but the one that I think was really pretty funny is I was in Seattle and this lady came up to me after the show and, she said, so am I supposed to understand from your act that you don't think, science and religion are compatible? And I said, well, no, I wouldn't say that, but why? Why do you say that? She says, well, I'm a scientist and I'm religious. And I said, oh, that's fine. And then she started going into, so you know that all the studies that we've done show that prayer works and that the earth is 6,000 years old. And I'm like, what? I thought maybe she was actually a legitimate scientist who, and
she was doing a comedy routine. She must have been
like, oh, you're a shitty scientist.
But she goes, this is my husband. He's an atheist too. And he goes, and he was from Israel. He goes, I am a secular Jewish person. I'm not an atheist. She goes, he's like you. And he's in the back behind, and he's behind me going, God. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No, I'm not even kidding you. It was 2 hours of her talking, and I'm trying to be nice. And then eventually I just let the floodgates go and I started going off and then finally the guy cleaning up came over and he goes, lady, get the hell out of here. And she like walked out and that was it. And then, it was 2 hours of her like just trying to convince me that all the studies show that prayer works.
Yeah. That was her sacred cow. That was her thing that she had to believe.
Yeah. And it was she was a scientist. And I,
what kind of scientist, do you remember? It's not really that it's relevant.
Christian scientist.
Yeah.
Right.
But I get that a lot. I get a lot of people who will find one thing and they, I hated you. You didn't like this? No. Oh, that part was funny. What about this? Oh, no, that part was funny. What about this? Oh, no, that part was funny. So what part didn't you like? And then I find it's one joke that I did. Just thought I was talking to them directly. And exactly. Every show.
It's like counting the hits and ignoring the misses in a way. It's along those lines.
Yeah, they remember the one thing that pissed them off.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, we get that a lot too. We get a lot of emails. We read all the emails for all really useful feedback about our show and I pay close attention to it. But a lot of it, you could tell they're zeroing in on one thing. And then their assessment is, you guys always do this one thing that I don't like. It's like, actually, we almost never do that. And sometimes I could even count. Like, it's something objective that I could, like, count it up and say, actually, we do that 1% of the time.
Right.
So it's not all the time. But that it shows you how easily their perceptions are skewered, skewed, mm-hmm. and skewered, by its confirmation bias. Like that one thing bothers them, so they notice it every time it happens, and a totally distorted view of how much of our show it actually comprises.
A friend of ours that said, I'll never forget this, he said, oh, yeah, I mean, everything out there is bullshit except that voodoo. That's the one you, the one thing you pick right, that you're holding on to is freaking voodoo?
That voodoo.
Yeah.
It's got to be that voodoo. it's funny, though, because everybody has their little pet thing, but I've noticed that it's, for some reason, I can be on stage and talking about something that's not a belief necessarily. Like, I can be up there and make fun of whatever, rednecks. And rednecks come to me like, yeah, I'm just like that. Yeah. You know, and they think it's hilarious.
Yeah.
But if I touch on something that they believe at their core,
yeah. mm-hmm.
even if it's not religion, even if it's, again, if it's something like Bigfoot or astrology or something, and I say, and they really believe it at their core, they cannot laugh about it.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's all of a sudden, it's, they're the whole time they're waiting for me to,
yeah.
you know, yeah. I had a guy wait for me from the entire show. Because my first joke was a Trump joke, and he waited to the end to come up to me and go, so you don't like Trump? Wow, really? He wanted to leave, and you could see his wife or girlfriend was going, sit down, and he was just this for an hour.
Yeah. yeah.
So he could come up to me and tell me that, you know, and then he tried to be funny, but he goes, would you sleep with Donald Trump if it kept him from becoming president? I was like, really? That you waited an hour to ask me about it?
That was his big comeback.
Yeah, that was his fantasy.
Yeah. No, but you would.
Yeah. So that. Yeah. You, people are when you start touching. I guess that's why race, religion, beliefs, anything in that.
Don't talk about a Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So yeah, we've interviewed like other comedians and whatnot. I think it was Matt Stone who said you could get away with. That insulting people in the exact proportion of how funny you are. So as long as you're funny, that's like a blank check, but you gotta know if the joke had, or even in an individual joke, that joke was okay if it's funny enough. Doesn't matter how irreverent or insulting or whatever it is. So, but it's totally challenged. But then I think like George Carlin's a great example. I mean, George Carlin, obviously, the master comedian, but he, towards the end, especially of his career, he took the gloves off. He was really, he ridiculed religion and belief. And I thought it was hilarious. Right. But it seemed that he got away with it, like with the crowd.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I really wonder, I met him a few times. I really asked him. I really wonder how much he got. I mean, obviously, the internet's. They can nowadays find you. Back in his day, they would have to send him a letter, I guess, or whatever. But I get specifically. I have a bit about alternative medicine, and it's just this long 5-7 minute bit about lots of things in alternative medicine. But the one main thing is me kind of debunking. I hate that word, but this idea that big pharma is keeping down the cures for everything and cancer specifically, like, oh, there's a cure for cancer and they're paying off millions of people, you know, every year to shut up about the cure for cancer. And because, you know, because they make a gazillion dollars a minute on the treatment or whatever. So I have this joke about it, and I've twice now received books, once an e-book and once a physical book from somebody who heard me on the radio. On like Sirius XM or whatever, some sort of thing that they heard me on the radio, that bit specifically found me and sent me something to that they either had written or that they read. And then, so twice actual books and then several other times emails showing me how
wrong you were.
How wrong I was with the cure for cancer.
You piss a lot of people off.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, you sent me a book. Yeah. That's crazy. You know, or would you please read this because you're wrong? I wonder if Carl
get those too, you know, because I have thousands of, you know, blogs online and people find them and then they write me.
Or they sue us,
occasionally sue us.
Yeah.
But what's amazing to me, though, I'll get this long ranting email of, you know, criticizing me for defending science and medicine, and it's full of, it's like cookie cutter bullshit. You know, it's like this person, there's not an original thought in the entire email. It's like somebody downloaded, you know, anti-science propaganda into this person, and they're regurgitating it. You know, they're vomiting it forward as if it's somehow insightful, and then they're accusing me of like being a tool. Like, dude, really? You don't realize that you are a tool of anti-science propaganda. Yes. You just regurgitate it. I've received a million emails with these exact arguments.
Right.
They have no basis
it's
in reality.
Like a plagiarized letter. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know this person? Because you copied his email.
Yeah. It's a, but yeah. They think that they're so insightful, and right. they don't realize how programmed they are.
Yep. Yeah.
That's just
yeah.
programmed BS that you're regurgitating that. Yeah, it's really sad.
I think it's, and the weird thing to me is I say, you realize you heard a 5-minute comedy routine on the radio. It's not like I'm selling anything, but it was actually, you know, they say never read your reviews, but I accidentally saw I was clicking on
I accidentally Googled myself.
No, seriously, I was on like some whatever thing. I was trying to send somebody a link to watch something, right?
Yeah.
So I went to like copy the thing, and the first thing somebody had same exact bit the alternative medicine bit, and I saw this and I went, what is this? And I started reading it. Bad news. The guy was saying how he loved me and it was great and. I'm still going to give him 5 stars because I thought he was funny. But this one bit about alternative medicine, he's obviously been paid.
Yeah,
been paid off.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So like, where's the check going?
Where is the money?
For that one joke.
Yes. Yeah. You're like, okay, Big Pharma.
They called me up.
That joke that I'm going to say for you, that's going to cost you $50.
Yeah. Right? They actually called me ahead of time. They said, look, we really need you to write a joke.
Yeah.
To quell the fears of the public.
And now you get residuals in the mail that are signed by Big Pharma. Yeah. Like every few weeks.
It is just BP.
BP. You know what I love telling people whenever that comes up? I'm like, do you know what car I'm driving? If I'm a shill, I'm clearly taking it all the way because I just watch, look at the clothes I wear, look where I live, and look at the car I drive. You're like, what am I doing with all the money?
You got all your money tied up in cash.
Yeah.
The shittiest shill ever. I'll take $4 for that.
That's the way to look at it.
That's their go-to though, right?
Yeah,
it's like,
right.
It's amazing how quickly people assume that you're paid for what, because right. you just, how could, nobody could have that opinion. So you must be a paid shill.
Well, that's the thing that kills me, especially with which is kind of what my joke's about. The thing about the cancer thing is, what would it take for me to be quiet about the cure for cancer? And I'm like, there's not enough money to buy me off. And I think to myself, well, maybe that's because I'm not a Republican. And, no, but I don't know. But I don't know. I really don't know what, like, how much money would it take me to be, you know, and then I think, how many people would they have to pay off?
Yeah.
And it's like the numbers, I mean, just, right. it's ridiculous. And I think, how does anyone not just think of that one basic, oh, you know what, they'd probably have to pay off at least several thousand people worldwide, and each one of them would cost several $100 million because it's freaking cancer.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know.
We covered that on the show, right? That those calculations of like how
it collapses within moments. Yeah,
yes, right. within moments.
How many people would have to be quiet?
2 seconds.
Yeah. It's
and no matter what, no matter how many times you point that out, they just same kind of a.
As Steve said, they're programmed.
Right, right. Yeah. They're not thinking.
Too deep.
This actually segues nicely into the first news item I want to talk about, which is about GMOs or genetically modified organisms. There are two actual stories to do with this, but they both have in common this notion that people can invent their own reality. And it's amazing how they can do that. They can just manufacture their own reality to fit their ideology. So the first one, and we've talked about GMOs a few times on the show. I've been writing about it a lot. It's really, I think, a big issue for the skeptical community to face because I think it's one where the disconnect, in fact, it is the issue where the disconnect between public understanding and opinion and scientific knowledge is the greatest. At least in, you know, surveys show that's the issue. Even more so than things like global warming and even evolution. So that we have our job cut out for us. So one small aspect of this whole GMO story is happening in Bangladesh. The government in, you know, cooperation with universities have been researching how to make a BT version of various cultivars of brinjal. Brinjal is their word for eggplant. That's a staple.
What is BT? What do you say BT?
So BT is a pest. It's a pesticide, right?
Okay.
So it occurs naturally in bacteria. It produces it. So they were able to take the gene from the bacteria, put it in certain plants. So there's BT corn. There's BT cotton. And now there's BT Brinjal.
So the plants are growing it themselves.
They're producing the pesticide themselves.
And plants do, don't, some plant varieties actually do produce their own BT. It's just in such low quantities, it's not as, you know.
But, so all plants produce pesticides, right? And in fact, 99.999% of the pesticides that will ever work their way into your body were produced naturally in plants. Not added by people, not genetically modified. That's just the world, right? That's how plants survive.
Yeah, otherwise they die.
They evolved to protect themselves against. It's literally a war going on, you know, between pests and plants. But you know, when we farm, though, it's like here's acres and acres and acres of the same plant. So it's an invitation, for pests to come in and adapt to that new food source. And pests and crops have sort of co-evolved along with weeds, et cetera. So there's the root borer is one particular pest that could wipe out 40%, pretty much on average, about 40% of the brinjal crop will be wiped out by the root borer. And farmers have to spray a couple of times a week. They say about 140 to 180 times. They'll have to spray pesticide on their brinjal crop just to keep the damage down to 40%.
What's brinjal?
It's eggplant.
Eggplant. Why don't you say eggplant then?
Because that's what they call it.
That's what they call it.
See, this is a typical scientist, right? He knows that everybody in the goddamn room knows what the word eggplant means. But you have to use the brinjal plant.
And typical Jay wasn't listening when he already defined what brinjal was.
He did not say that.
Yes, he did.
It's late. I was sitting out there for like an hour.
Right, but I'm a good scientist. I said brinjal, which is eggplant. Right. I use the technical term and then I explain it.
Well, so how much are you getting paid by Big Brinjal?
Yeah, right. Monsanto, man. You know, the guy right outside there. Right,
Steve, if they use the pesticide and lose 40%, what would they lose without pesticide?
Oh, the whole crop.
The whole thing.
It would be... Yeah, that's how bad it is. So,
I love brinjal parmesan.
Yeah, brinjal parmesan.
Yeah. Yeah.
A Bangladeshi delicacy.
So, this is a big deal. Now they have four cultivars of brinjal with that cultivar J is like one specific variety of a crop.
Yes.
Cultivar.
Thank you.
Yeah, right. So, they're giving it to farmers to test it out. It's already gone through field testing. It's actually approved for use. So they're saying they're just giving it to farmers for free. And the farmers love it. It's great. So it's reduced their pesticide applications by 80%.
Wow.
More than 80% reduction. And they have almost no loss of crop. Their crop reduction is down to almost nothing. There are still other things that can happen to plants. If you water it too much, you can get some wilt and which is a bacteria. There's other pests that they have to spray for, but the main pest is taken care of, so it's fantastic. They love it. Their profits are up. Their spraying is way way down. It's win-win all over.
And it's better
around.
For the environment when they don't have.
Of course,
spray.
Better for them, for their health, better for the environment.
The groundwater, yeah.
And again, this is their staple crop, right? This is not just something nice to have. This is like what they're living off of. So this is a home run for genetic modification, right? For GM crops, there's no corporate profit involved. There's, no decreases pesticide use. There's no Frankenfood here at all. This is pretty much, a win-win scenario. So, of course, the anti-GMO crowd can't just sit by and let this happen because this ruins their narrative, right? Their narrative is about that the farmers are supposed to hate this and it's supposed to be for corporate profit and it's supposed to be bad for the environment and bad for your health. And none of those things are happening. So, but that's not their reality, right? That's not their narrative. So they have to now reinvent reality to fit their narrative. So when the stories of how wonderful everything was going were starting to come back, and there were science programs and reporters reporting on how wonderful this is all working out, they actually, some dedicated anti-GMO activists went to Bangladesh posing as reporters to sort of interview the farmers. And then they come back telling stories like, oh, they got it all wrong. The farmers hate it. Their crops are failing. The BT doesn't work. They're still getting destroyed by... Or, meanwhile, they're also telling the farmers, oh, yeah, don't eat the brinjal. It causes birth defects and makes you sterile.
So they're basically going in there. They're lying to the farmers, and then they're lying to everybody else on the outside.
Yeah, so the reporters who did the original story is like, wait, that's not what we found when we went there. So they went back, and they interviewed the farmers on video. So you could watch the video of the farmers. Of course, you could think that they're all being paid off. It's all bullshit, but whatever. The farmers are like... No, this reporter showed up and was asking me about my plants and they asked about the plants that were dying, and I explained to them those ones had already produced, and they were at the end of their lifespan, and that's what happens at the end. You know, after they've already produced, they will die. And, you know, so they interpreted the plants that were dying a natural death as failed crops, which is just not true. And then they were pointing at the plants that where the root borers were invading them and destroying the crops. And yeah, those were our control plants. Those are not BT.
Oh my God.
Plants. But they interpreted that as a failure of the BT.
Yeah.
So not so good at science.
No, not so good. So, but yeah, I mean, but you wonder though, like, so did they know that they were completely getting the story wrong, or they were just seeing what they wanted to see?
Yeah.
Yes and yes.
Yeah. So it probably has a weird combination of those two things. Hard to really parse that apart, but. They now have their story to tell that fits their narrative, and so you know that if you're an part of the anti-GMO crowd and you look it up, you go, oh, but this guy says that it's failing and the farmers are unhappy and it's not working anyway and the plants are dying.
It's going to get legs and
it feeds their community. It's like when you talk to an anti-vaxxer, they are full of misinformation, but that's the information that's going around their community. That's their narrative. It's just they're building their alternate reality, and it doesn't matter what the facts on the ground are.
Yeah.
It's amazing. All right. So the other story. Actually, this morning or yesterday morning, I got an email from one of our listeners. I thought they were actually advocating this story, but then it turns out they were just, oh, no, I don't believe that. I was just making sure you guys saw this. So it's a similar situation where there are articles going around the anti-GMO, you know, websites like Organics and GM Watch and Right to Know and all these websites that the story is the GMO that almost ended the world. Okay.
Yep.
I haven't heard that one.
Wait, so this brindle crop.
This is a different story entirely.
Oh, it's a different. Okay, so we're off that.
Yeah.
I'm just checking.
Well played.
Now, because if eggplant was going to ruin the world, I think I would have heard about this.
Yeah. All right, so here's the story. And it didn't take me long to deconstruct this story. You know, I always like this. When I reply, say, it took me 5 minutes to find that this was total BS. But anyway, the story is that a European company was researching a soil bacteria, Klebsiella plantacola. That's a plantacola.
Yeah. Oh, uh-oh. Now we know he's behind it.
Yeah, Klebsiella plantacola. It's a root bacteria, right? So it lives on the roots of plants, and it lives symbiotically with the plants. So they came up with a good idea. It's like, okay, so we're going to insert a gene into this Klebsiella to convert some of the plant cellulose or whatever into ethanol, and then we could then take the dying plants and then turn them into biofuels. Right? Sounds good. So then another scientist did a small like pilot study where they put the bacteria in wheat. I think it was wheat and a couple other plants, and the bacteria produced ethanol in the soil to toxic levels and killed the plants.
Didn't work.
Well, at least that particular, the study actually wasn't designed to really test the effect of the bacteria so much as like how it should be studied. Like it was just creating a paradigm for studying the effects of the bacteria.
But, a pilot study.
Right. But somehow an environmental group got a hold of the scientist and then they gave testimony before like the New Zealand, whatever. And their testimony was, that this bacteria was about to be field tested, and if it had been field tested, it would have gotten out into the world and killed every plant on Earth.
Jesus.
There are some plants that don't grow in soil.
Yeah. Well, she did say terrestrial.
I see. Okay.
Every
she was clear about
terrestrial,
that.
Terrestrial, not going to overstate the plant. Every terrestrial plant on Earth will be dead. Okay, so that seems to be going a little bit beyond the evidence, just a little bit.
A little hyperbole.
So what I found was her apology for misinforming, giving bad testimony, you know, before this New Zealand council. Essentially, she cited a paper that hadn't been published. That's a no-no. She also incorrectly said that the bacteria was being field tested, and that was incorrect. It had not yet been approved for field testing. And she also said, and, you know, I really can't say from my study that it would have destroyed every terrestrial plant on the Earth. So,
other than that, it was totally fine.
So never mind everything I
said. Never mind. Never mind.
Strike it from the record.
Right, but it's too late.
Too late.
This is me now. Is the GMO that almost destroyed the world is now out there. Right?
It reminds me of like when you are watching court proceedings and somebody said, like a witness says something and then there's an objection.
Strike it
and then
the
they
record.
Have to, and it's basically like jurors, you will not use any of that. And it's like, you can't unhear it.
Yeah.
Like, how do you just not factor what you just heard?
When a judge says, strike that, I always think that's such bullshit.
I know.
Because the lawyers use that. They use it. They know
they'll
that
intentionally make an objection because they know it's a worm in your head now.
Yeah. Or they say something they know is going to be objected to.
Yeah, they don't.
That's right. To get it on record.
So I mean, and I've been in courtrooms where lawyers have said something like that, and then the other attorney says, "I object," and before the judge has said anything, I'll strike it. Like, I've already put that bug in the juror's ears, and now I don't care. I don't want it actually on the record.
They need a time delay, like radio. Like radio stations, time delay. No, you got to buzz it before it gets to the juror.
So the jurors are like in a big cage, and there's like a delay.
That's actually really interesting, Bob. Like a 3-minute time delay to the jurors that they can because
they only let through what's been approved
by the judge. Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Because we know enough about psychology, we know enough about skepticism to know that there's just no way that they're not going to use that information in their.
So the thing is,
don't think about an elephant.
Yeah, in this meme, right? It's a GMO, even though it's a bacteria, right? Or bacterium, the species. Okay, I totally get the idea that you shouldn't release a genetically modified, like virus or bacteria, into the wild without studying the crap out of it, right? I mean, yeah, they're very rapidly self-replicating, you know, infectious types of things, and you know, you have to think very carefully about releasing, they're like insects or another one. Like before we release insects out into the world, into the wild, I would want to, you know, really be sure that they're not going to screw things up, right?
Yeah, like the CRISPR mosquitoes, like the Zika, all that.
Not that we would never do it, but I mean, that's all right. That's a high level of concern, and that the research would be high. Crops are really weak things, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting because the anti-GMO world, in the anti-GMO world, if a rogue GMO crop gets out into the wild, it's going to destroy nature.
Monsanto's already doing that. They're infecting every field with
there's
their
this
GM wheat.
The wheat one that's coming.
And then they're suing all of the farmers.
Do you realize how fragile crops are? They need to be babied by farmers.
Those weeds in my yard.
Yeah, but they're not
I can't
crops.
Get rid of. Right?
Monsanto weeds.
Yeah.
That's why.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They should just take those crops, whatever's keeping them alive, and put them, like, infuse that with, like, good crops. And,
that's
like,
what they're doing. Yeah. That's what genetic modification is.
Oh, we invented that shit 30 years too late.
Right. Yeah, it's not like that. Like, they're railing all, like, this. There's like a few, you know, rogue GMO wheat plants that somehow the seeds got out and they're growing in a field. It's going to destroy everything. It's like, this shit's not kudzu. You know what I mean? It's not going to, it's a crop. The things that, you know, we've made them to be nutritious and food, but not to like grow in the wild. They're really fairly gimped as far as that's concerned, you know?
They're high maintenance.
Yeah, they're high maintenance. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, this is an example of not a failure of the scientific method here, but it's an example of it working. Obviously, you pilot the pilot, you know, as it were. You have this little test. You show that maybe there are some things that are not probably what we had hoped for.
Yeah.
And then you move on from there.
So, yeah, this is a totally approach. Even if taken at face value, that the story is not alarming at all, the science showed that there's an potential issue here. We shouldn't be releasing this into the wild because it could kill plants. Fine. But actually, there was another study that they didn't, you know, cite in the scaremongering stories where, you know, the other scientists looking at the same bacteria found that when you combined it with the wild type bacteria, the plants didn't die. Yeah. Which means the GMO bacteria wasn't competing against the wild type bacteria. So it's not going to take over the world. Even if it got released out there, the regular bacteria would have kicked its ass.
Yeah.
Because again, you know, the wild types, they're adapted to the environment. The stuff we're making in the lab is not super anything. It's
just
different.
But there is always that assumption, right? That it's somehow it's
super.
Like a, yeah, yeah, like it's like we've made it radioactive and it will kill anything in its path. And it's like, no, it just has like one gene modified to make it slightly sweeter.
Yeah. No, but that is the Frankenfood meme. That's the whole idea. It is basically exploiting the public programming from science fiction and superhero movies. The notion that you're a mutant you're somehow super something, and then so these things are going to take over the world and destroy the ecosystems. Like, no, they're just plants. They're just plants, you know. But they're resistant to glyphosate. Yes, so what? You know, we're not throwing the stuff around.
All that natural glyphosate.
Who cares?
So the one I always hear is, but it's. They used a fish gene.
Yeah. That's the one that always
it's fish right. Made.
That's right.
Yeah, it's tomato. A fish made.
Why do they say fish? Why is that so scary? Why is that the fear-mongering gene?
Like, I think because it's fish. It's so make it foreign. Stinky. It's not another plant. Yeah. Like fish are kind of like.
So first of all,
we share how many genes with fish?
That crap?
We share 60% of our more. I think we share 60% of our genes with bananas.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we share more than that, 70 or something like that, with fish. It's not a fish gene. It's a gene. There's no difference.
Right.
It's a gene. But the other thing is,
made of the same four.
We never made the fish mato. It was just an idea that somebody had, right?
But what was it supposed to do? It was supposed to have omega-3 in it or something?
No, it was cold tolerance. They were putting cold tolerance from a fish into a tomato so it wouldn't freeze in the fall or whatever, extend the growing season. It's actually a really good idea, and they should do it. But, you know, whatever, the fish mato, that just became another meme within the anti-GMO community, even though it never existed. And it's not a bad idea anyway. And the whole idea that there are fish genes and tomato genes is bullshit.
Well, and even if they're, the weird thing is, I remember reporting on some strawberries with Kevin Folta down at his lab in Florida, and reporting on some tomatoes, some strawberries, some peppers, and we were talking about the different kind of experimental genetic modification that they were doing, mostly to resist certain types of pests. And they were finding that within the public consciousness, if you put like a pepper gene into a different kind of pepper, like this pepper has better resistance, so we're going to insert it into this other species of pepper, which doesn't have as good. And people are like, yeah, I'm generally okay with that. Yeah. But like you put a pepper gene in like a strawberry, and they're like, it's gonna make my strawberry spicy. Yeah. You know, it's like they just can't fathom like two totally different organisms.
I think
like
Steve's
racism
right, though,
is what it really is.
It's racism. But
it's kind of like an artifact of our culture in a sense, like Steve was saying, because it really does seem like, you know, there's a million movies out there and books about, like, you know, I just think of like The Fly, right? The movie The Fly, where the guy merges with the fly.
It's the sci-fi. It's the sci-fi. Of it all.
No, and when asked, most people thought that the fish mato would taste like fish.
Yeah.
Of course.
No, they didn't put the flavor genes in it. They put the cold.
Yeah, right.
Why would they do that? They wouldn't be able to sell it.
Now, you know, isn't that though all of the this stuff, the fear mongering, all of the anti-science sort of stuff, is it? It's always kind of a big straw man where they are arguing with their own, with themselves.
Yeah, they
make
up the problem.
They have this crazy idea. It's like when you talk to people with evolution, it's like, well, I didn't do this and I didn't come from no monkey. And it's like, well, no one ever said any of that stuff. You're arguing with your own brain.
Like,
you made it up and then you deep, like, this is going to happen. And then, no, it's wrong. And so that's not how, no one said that. And it's every single time. It's the same thing. They have no understanding of it. So they make it up. And then they break down what they made up.
Yeah, that's the definition of fighting that straw man.
It's a spontaneous straw man.
You know, Jay, following up with what you said, this is like a societal thing. It's like a function somehow that's deep within us. I would urge all of you, when you go home, to do an image search. Like, doing journalism on GMOs is really interesting because you always have to tag your story with an image. And if you go to a stock photography website, like iStockPhoto or Shutterstock, and you just put in GMO, the images that come
up. They have a ton of them.
It's always like a tomato with a syringe in it.
It's always a syringe.
Or like a head of cabbage with teeth. And you're like, what is that? Like,
and you know the photographer's like,
what if cabbage is real?
Let's come up with two things.
I would buy that.
It's never just like,
let's have a big like dick growing out of this cabbage and see if people freak out.
It's never like, it's never a scientist with like a beaker, because that's really what it is. You know, it's like just.
What's with the syringe though? I mean, they're not injecting stuff into tomatoes.
It's scary, guys.
It's because it's provocative. That's why the dick should be coming out of the cabbage, because it would sell newspapers.
Why cabbage?
Just trust me, No.
Dick cabbage?
What?
I think Dick Mato sounds better. First Dick Mato.
Oh, nice.
Dick cabbage. Dick cabbage. Like Dick cabbage.
Dick cabbage.
Yes, of course.
I don't know what that means.
But he could. He could endorse it.
Hey, we're on
to
something.
It's like an SNL where John Hamm was selling the John Hamm.
Right.
It's like a roll of ham.
It's Dick cabbage.
John Hamm's John Hamm.
All right. Why is it that people cleave to that sort of thing, to the emotional response, rather than cleaving to more evidence-based things? Why do people get drawn into that so immediately?
So why are people so concerned about the, or why do they have an emotional response first instead of thinking about the evidence? Because thinking is hard, right? And feeling is natural.
I don't think they're taught to. And I think it's not even thinking, because I know some people that actually, they think, they're thinkers and they're smart, intelligent people, but they've never been taught where good evidence comes from and how to acquire good evidence. So those people always end up being the crazy conspiracy theory people. They're asking questions and they've kind of got this logical process going on, but all of their information came from some crazy website and they didn't fact check anything, because no one ever taught them how to or to fact check. And I think a lot of times it's just that. It's just they were, this is the facts I have and that's all I know.
We all know people, and you know, Jay, Bob and I know several people like this who are, you know, armchair philosophers, right? So this is, and it's hard to talk about this without coming off as elitist, but basically these are people who don't have a lot of a formal education, but they are curious and they're interested in, you know, big ideas, and they want to participate in that, and they have their own ideas, but they don't have the, I think, perspective or maybe the humility to realize that you can't just shoot from the hip, you know what I mean? Sometimes people just, like, you know, we would be around at dinner and they would say, yeah, I always wondered about this. And they would have some half-baked crazy ideas. And that's fine. We could talk about that. But then there are people who, like, write a book. You know, like we know some guy who wrote a book. He had this wacky theory about how all of the Bible was actually influenced by aliens. And he had this really convoluted chain of evidence of how the Taj Mahal is a spaceship, and then, you know, it's like weird stuff.
It's not like a comedy book, though.
No, it's dead serious. So, like, he took it to the next level, you know, where now he's not just like armchair philosophizing at the dinner table. He actually thought this was publishable, and he published it, you know.
Yeah, but now he's an expert. Somebody else. Now he's an expert. Somebody else, he's like, well, have you read so and so?
Who published it? Marvel Comics?
All right. Kara, you're going to tell us whether or not dogs can understand what we're saying to them.
Yes.
Because I know we certainly act as if they do.
We do.
Yeah.
So anybody who's kind of been on Tay Interwebs this week has probably seen this story circulating about dogs in an fMRI scanner and dogs being able to understand human language. When I first saw it, I was losing my mind, because a puppy in an MRI is like the cutest thing ever. And so I wanted to read more about it. It turns out that these neuroscientists in Budapest in Hungary trained 13 different dogs to get an fMRI. We will talk about that later. And they were interested specifically in language processing. And so it was actually this week that their findings were published in Nature, a very big publication. And the lead researcher, Attila Andix, he was particularly interested in exploring the difference between what we say and how we say it. So the meaning of the words and the intonation of the words. And in an effort to investigate both of those things, he built up a 2x2 study design, which is very common, where in this paradigm, the dog's in the scanner, and then you have recordings of their trainer's voice either saying positive terms like good boy, and either doing it in a sort of positive way, good boy, or in a very neutral way, good boy. And then you've got neutral terms like such as, which mean nothing.
I don't know, that one beauty pageant contestant made
that's
a whole
true.
Speech
she did
as
make
such
a whole
as.
Such as the Iraqs and the such as. Yes. And
she win?
The Iraqs.
The Iraqs. So, and then the neutral term was also done in a such as, and then such as. And they wanted to look at the brain of the dog during these different words. And there were multiple. It wasn't just one thing. And
did they do negative terms?
They didn't. They only did positive and neutral.
So
there's no bad. There's no bad dog, and there's no yelling. It was all positive and neutral. Yeah. And so here's what they found. They found that praise words showed activation in the left hemisphere of dogs, whether or not they were spoken with a positive intonation.
Cool.
So good boy and good boy. Same. They saw activation in the left hemisphere. They saw that in the right hemisphere, in a region of the dog brain specifically, which is called the middle ectosylvian gyrus, there was elevated activity that was correlated with a neutral intonation, actually a lower voice, regardless of the meaning of the words. So whether they were positive words or neutral words, if they were said in a neutral way, they saw activation in this one specific part of the right hemisphere. And then they also found that the reward centers in the dog's brain only showed elevated activity when positive words were spoken with positive intonation. Mm. So because of that, actually, before that, I should say, it's easy to interpret these in a way that very much mirrors what we think about human language. And that's exactly what the study authors did. They said that because language processing is lateralized in most humans on the left side of the brain, the fact that the positive terms showed left side activation shows that they understood the positive words, because that's where these words are processed in a human brain. And they interpreted the right side to be reflective of our right hemispheres, which typically process like what we call prosody of language, like the emotional components of language. And there they were talking about the difference between this kind of talking and very neutral speaking. So dogs are really mimicking or mirroring the way that humans understand language. And because of that, you saw all sorts of ridiculous headlines coming out. You saw, I pulled some samples that are really great. Brain scan confirms dogs understand what you're saying and how you're saying it. That was a very common headline that you see. MRI study shows that dogs understand vocabulary. Dogs can understand human speech, scientists discover. Your dog is too smart to be fooled by your fake happy voice. And scientists prove dogs understand human words. Okay. But is that really what they showed? When you look at some authors and some articles that take a more skeptical approach, you start to see some good arguments being made. Take Neuroskeptic's blog for Discover Magazine, for example. He looks at these findings and he asks, well, if left lateralization occurs when the dogs hear positive words, regardless of intonation, could it not just be a simple function of the fact that dogs recognize those words?
Yeah.
Because you don't go up to your dog ever and go, such as. You often walk up your dog and you say, walkies? You want to go to walk? You want to go outside and walk? Or you might say, you want to go on a walk, dude? Let's go on a walk. You might say it in different ways, but those
you
are
walkies?
Words.
Say walkies?
Yeah, walkies.
Yeah, so you're saying that they just have been trained over time to understand it. When you say you want to go for a walk, it means we're going, that you're physically
going to
take them
outside. Maybe it's not an understanding of the language, the meaning of the language, but an association between those phonemes, those physical sounds, and a positive expectation. There's a recognition that those words are words that they hear quite often. It's just a repetition thing. Perhaps it's just straight classical conditioning, like we all learned
about. But, Kara, couldn't you say, though, at that point, if the dog knows when you say you want to go for a walk, that means leash goes on and we go outside, that the dog does understand what going for a walk is and therefore knows that the word means the activity.
And so the question here is, how do we really fully define language? Is it a noise that represents an activity only, or is there deeper meaning to semantics? And what are we talking about when we say that dogs understand language? And that's really what I think most of these authors are trying to parse out. Are we talking about a handful of labels that represent a positive outcome for a dog? Or a handful of labels that simply represent recognition for a dog? It might not even have anything to do with it being a positive outcome, but just a sound that's often heard, and that then activated activity in the brain, you know?
What about this? I saw an interesting show that showed the smartest dog in the world. Mm-hmm. Supposed to be the smartest dog.
Here comes an anecdote.
It's
not Bob.
Take it for whatever it is, but it was impressive from my point of view. They put like 200 objects in a room.
Yes, I remember this. This is a Harvard dog,
They brought the dog, get the cat toy. It ran in and got it. Get the ball. It got everything that was asked for. It went in and got it. And it associated, apparently, the word to the object in that room and got it and retrieved it. I mean.
Well, the more fascinating thing about that dog is that they specifically, it understood objects matched to their labels, their semantic labels. Mm-hmm. And when they said, go get the Flurgenflog, and the dog had never heard of that, it would go get a toy that it had not yet been trained on, which was actually quite, like, that was really the fascinating part of that study. But again, how do we define this as an understanding of what those words mean, or do we define this as a classical conditioning through hours and hours of training that dog to identify those certain phonemes with that certain object?
Right.
Is that really language? Because language, by definition, is inventive. Language is creative. And I think the interesting thing is that what we have to be cautious about when we talk about these kinds of studies, and what the study authors talk about, is that perhaps the dog brain is indicative of an evolutionary path that predates language. And it's really, there's nothing special about the human brain, because we see parallel features within the dog brain and there's nothing special about the human brain that allowed us to come up with language. It was another sort of cortical convention. And I think that's where I get very grain of salty with these kinds of studies. Another thing that a couple skeptical authors pointed out is they didn't pretest for baseline left hemisphere activation. So it could just be that hearing things, you know, activated that. And also, it, you know, may have nothing to do with speech. It's just an elevated, you know, response to the testing protocol. And also, there are only 13 test subjects in this study. So we have to take it with a grain of salt, knowing that a single, when you only have 13 subjects, a single subject can change the outcome of your results, you know, dramatically. But guys, we're missing the most important part of this study. How the F did they get 13 dogs to lay in an fMRI scanner? Well,
they at least understood sit still.
Yeah.
They understood
and
that.
When I say sit still, I mean sit still. Because when there were some cool follow-up interviews with the trainer of these within this lab, because a lot of people apparently had a similar question. If a dog licks its lips, it's going to render most of this data useless because it's going to move around too much to lick its lips. And so they talked about the progressive training, which took months to be able to get these dogs to get in the scanner.
All right, Evan. So I understand the FDA has banned antibacterial soap.
Yes, finally.
Banned it outright.
A final ruling has been passed down. Now, it's been a recommendation for several...
It was their final solution to this.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Is that where we're going to go? Is that where we're going? Yes. Right from their release, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration issued the final rule establishing that over-the-counter consumer antiseptic wash products containing triclosan and triclocarbon can no longer be marketed. The companies will no longer be able to market antibacterial washes with these ingredients because manufacturers did not demonstrate that the ingredients are both safe for long-term daily use and more effective than plain soap and water in preventing illness and the spread of certain infections. And some manufacturers have, in fact, already started to go ahead and remove these ingredients from the product.
Oh, so there's no science showing that an actual antibacterial agent, antimicrobial agent in your soap is any better than just a typical soap.
Right. That's right.
Interesting.
That's right. The mandate came down in 2013, and the FDA said, all right, companies, you have to prove to us, show us conclusively that there's a benefit here. Because we know what the risks are, and we know the harms that it is doing, and they were unable to do it. So
it just seems like an obvious like slam dunk. Like, okay, doesn't work, doesn't do what you're supposed to, just stop producing those chemicals and stop putting them in soaps everywhere.
Yeah, and this is something we've been talking about actually for a long time, Bob. I know you've been talking about this with people, you know, and you yourself many years ago stopped purchasing those kinds of product or using it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little confused though because my take on it was that we shouldn't use it because most of these bacteria are benign and you don't want to get rid of them because if you get rid of the benign bacteria that may be on your skin, what's going to take its place? So that was the big problem for me. But now I'm hearing from them that it wasn't doing it. It appears to be not be doing anything at all. I would think that, I mean, if you've got an antibiotic in the soap, I would think it would be killing some bacteria, but it
wasn't. No, there's a difference between not showing that, they weren't asked to show that it actually kills harmful bacteria. They were asked to show that it has an outcome, like an efficacy in terms of keeping you healthier, right?
Right, that's right, yeah.
Like that it is more effective than soap in preventing disease or something.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah, I think antimicrobial kills.
Yeah, that's why I didn't.
But so
microbes.
Does soap. You know, just
but so does soap.
Yeah, that's the thing. Washing your hands
in hot water, guys. Use hot water. Like, yeah,
my doctor said that one time. I said something about antibacterial soap, and she goes, "All soap's antibacterial."
Yeah. 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 I don't think hot water. True. We don't wash our hands in water temperature that's hot enough to really do anything.
You're supposed to wash your hands in water that's hot enough for you to be able to just hot enough to be able to stand it. Is that not true?
I don't think the temperature of the water matters.
That's pretty hot.
The one thing that matters the most is scrubbing time. That's
time.
Really,
like the vigorous.
It's the physical, mechanical scrubbing with soap. That's what makes the difference.
Happy birthday to
you. Yeah, there's no magic numbers.
It says that sometimes in the airport.
I see the two. That's a good rule of thumb, but it also depends on your technique.
That's true.
Yeah, we've talked about triclosan also in the past in regards to toothpaste.
Yeah.
I brought it up because it's in some toothpaste products. It is.
Why?
And that because it does, it that has been proven to show a benefit in the reduction of gingivitis.
Oh, interesting.
So that's going to remain. So triclosan is not gone entirely from our products. Now,
so what does this mean for things like, what's it called? Not Bactine, but the green one, like green soap, like things that you need to wash hand your gel? Hands with antibacterial soap in the hospital.
Hippocleanse.
Like when I get a tattoo and I have an open wound, that's the only time when I use that kind of, like the more pharmaceutical feeling.
Yeah, that's
like
more, it's more antiseptic than antibacterial. So things that are antiseptic just kill cells, you know? It's not, there's no specific targeting of bacteria. It's just like, I always say,
kill viruses too.
Like Lysol, the name Lysol means it lyses all, right? Yeah. And lice means it forces a cell to break apart, right? So that's why it's great for cleaning counters, because, you know.
You don't want cells there.
Yeah, you can completely sterilize. It will sterilize.
In case you're trying to get away with murder.
Yes.
In forensic files,
We had an audience question. Yes, sir.
Hang on. Wait, hold on.
Is it true or an urban myth that antibacterial soaps help to create superbacteria?
That would be a myth.
Yeah, Joel, to answer your question, I heard the same thing, and I thought for a long time that, if you keep using this antibacterial soap, we're going to have bacteria that's super strong because all the weak stuff got killed off, but apparently that's all BS.
But that is how bacterial resistance does develop. Like, it's not about the bacteria themselves, it's about their genes. Right? And it's about certain bacteria in the wild are always going to have evolved by some random mutagen an ability to live even beyond some sort of substance that's made to kill them. If you basically create an environment where there's not a lot of competition, where you allow those bacteria to thrive, you're going to see that gene moving out into the general population of bacteria more and more. That's how we see quote-unquote superbugs developing. Because bacteria swap genes all the time. It's not just about those specific little guys living, even though that's important too. There's actually physically genetic material that's being swapped around in them a lot, which is... But I guess, so you're saying that there's not a lot of evidence that there's any sort of like skin bacteria that tends to...
Not from the soap. Yeah.
It's more the types of bacteria that already make you quite sick that we're concerned about. Because it's not about this bacteria is now any more angry. It's just that now the drug doesn't work against it. And something as simple as strep, if you don't treat it, could kill you. Yeah. We don't think about that, but there are basic diseases that we get all the time that are like, hey, you just take a pill. Mm-hmm. But like those diseases could kill you if they go untreated.
Yeah,
they can move into your brain. They can make you very, very sick. Staph infections are horrible.
Yeah, oh God.
I thought you said stab infections. I'm like, yeah, those could be bad.
Yeah, you usually get an infection from a stab.
Right, exactly. All right, Jay.
This will be quick, but it's very interesting.
Yeah.
So this is SpaceX had an accident. So Facebook had a
Facebook had
a satellite on the rocket. It exploded. So we've already talked about how SpaceX and Elon Musk has the idea, like, okay, we could screw up. Like they're pushing their technology a lot, and they're trying to get it iterating very fast so they make a lot of progress in a short amount of time. And this is really not how NASA behaves. NASA is very careful because NASA is usually sending people into outer space in a lot of their missions. We were talking about this earlier today, and we got on to the topic of, well, you know, what death rate is acceptable, right? So there's going to be accidents. But when you start putting people on these rockets, when SpaceX, you know, and they're talking about it, it's going to happen. When is enough, or what's the threshold here? So as an example, I took some statistics from the space shuttle. They had 833 total number of crew member in all the space shuttle missions. There was 135 space shuttle missions. 14 astronauts were killed in the two accidents that took place. So I did the math real quick. 94.5 days equals one fatality, right? So you get 94.5 days in the space shuttle missions. And you have to lose a person to get that many days in space. That's a pretty serious statistic, right? Oh, my God. You know, it doesn't seem like that much time in space.
Does NASA have one of those signs, you know, 120 days?
space-based
fatality.
Yeah, so...
Shit, you gotta go to zero again.
The idea here is, you know, I'm sure that NASA is always trying to make things as safe as possible. But there is... it's dangerous. So that's, you know, do they have that safe enough, or they just iterate the safeness as much as they can afford? Or, you know, it's just a curious thing to think about. And like SpaceX is now getting into it, and they're, you know, I'm sure that they're thinking, you know, well, when we start sending people into outer space, let's go back to the technology that we've already tested and not put them out on the latest software that's driving the rockets or whatever. You know, this thing didn't even get off the launch pad. The thing blew up because it when I read, it was a very minor, like, not leveled situation going on, and it caused it to blow up, which I seems
and
sounds
it was
very...
It was a pre-launch test. It wasn't
yeah,
even
it was
a launch.
Just a test.
It wasn't even a scheduled launch.
So, again, the science worked, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because they never would have put people in it right. during a pre-launch test.
Yeah, yeah. right. Yeah. yeah.
It's true. But yeah, you think about that. So we lost two shuttles with 135 missions. That's, you know, with one disaster every 67 and a half.
Yeah,
67 and a half. Yeah, but so that's terrible.
Yeah, you're an astronaut getting on a space shuttle and you're doing the math and you're like, yeah, this is statistically, it's not, uncommon, whatever, but it can happen. It's not like one in a million or
sure,
whatever.
They know the risk.
Course,
you know?
Yeah.
They,
like we
they accept
about Apollo.
That risk.
These Apollo astronauts, I mean, they must have gone into it saying, could die.
Right.
Yeah. Like doing this early before they had those statistics.
They probably thought
it's
they
like,
had
I
a
might die.
Chance
yeah,
of
I might
dying.
Die, and that's just a risk I'm willing to take.
Yep. Right. Now, the other interesting thing about this, as we were talking about it, it occurred to us the real danger here is just going up and down. Because we have people in the space station, and there's been no fatalities. It, you know, seems to be going great.
And their signs do them really well.
Yeah. yeah.
Well, that's the real danger with mm-hmm. air, like flying, commercial flying too, right? It's like it's taking off and landing.
Yeah. yeah.
That's when the problems really occur. That's why it's so newsworthy when something like explodes over the Pacific or it's like, how did that happen?
Air,
you know,
right.
it's so rare.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the like, commercial airline safety record is orders of magnitude better.
God.
I mean, the probability of dying on a commercial airplane. I love the statistic. I love is
more dangerous
to the airport.
Yeah, in order to have a 50-50 chance of dying in a plane crash, you would need to fly every day for 500 years.
Yeah,
that's pretty damn reassuring.
And I think a big difference there is that we're talking about professional astronauts versus the general public using this as a consumer product, but eventually that is a goal, right?
Yeah,
the goal is space tourism.
Make it like an airline.
And there's going to be a totally different cutoff point for safety and risk by the time we're talking about people paying to take a ride.
So does that mean we're not as close as we think
to like parabolic flights just going up
casual
and down.
Flying by the public? Into space.
Yeah, but this rocket wasn't rated for human passengers, right? Their SpaceX isn't quite there yet.
It wasn't.
But
but again, they're pushing it. That's the thing that's interesting.
Right. They definitely going to have to shift to the NASA model of we got to get this to the point where you know there's going to be a major event very very rarely.
Yeah.
I mean, even I'm sure that's of course NASA's intention. NASA didn't go into the shuttle program thinking they were going to lose a couple of shuttles, you know, in 130 missions. Yeah, you got to be thinking, yeah, we got to get this down to like less than 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, you know, something like really 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 low.
And that's hard, right?
That's hard.
All the things that went wrong weren't things where they were like, oh yeah, we forgot to check that. They were things that they never would have thought except for the conversion, that weird conversion problem.
Well,
the O-ring they absolutely
the guy knew.
Just died recently.
Yeah,
the scientist NASA engineer who told them, guys, this is going to blow up. You know, there's a problem here. If you try to launch in cold weather, the thing, it's going to freeze.
And this is going to be
a catastrophic
thing. He was
ridiculed for it.
No, but he actually, like, to his grave, the guy was
blamed
tormented
himself.
His whole life.
Yeah. He didn't push far enough in convincing NASA that they shouldn't launch. So that was NASA had a systemic problem with their quality control. And they admit that, they fixed it. And then the second shuttle that blew up, that was a launch problem, even though it was on reentry. It was the foam breaking away and taking off a tile on launch. And then that hole in the wing.
There
was nothing they could do. They couldn't even look to see if what the damage was, so they had to land.
But that was a hindsight problem, right? It wasn't something where they were like, oh, we forgot to put that on the checklist.
They knew that foam was breaking off on launch. They were just hoping it wasn't going to cause a problem.
Gotcha.
And then it did. So, I think.
Don't you think though we should have?
That's actually more comforting to me.
Yeah.
To think that the couple of times that it happened, there were things, I mean, it's depressing. It's more depressing, but that they weren't things that we couldn't account for. They're things that we should have been accounting for. That actually bodes better for upping the safety program.
It's fixable.
Cool, but how cool would it have been, though, if it happened, to, you know, rewind and the crew is up there and they, well, we think that we've got, you know, a missing tile. And they had another ship, something, anything that could have gone up and given them, like, the glue that they needed to patch
the hole.
They
should have just had Mark Watney.
Yeah. Yeah, but we don't even do, like, even today, like, how many emergency ships do we have? Like, isn't the answer zero?
We have no way they can to get up
they
there.
Have ships
have
that
no
can
ships.
Get them from the space station to Earth, like the emergency escape ships, I think, that they can.
But, like, we here in the state, like, America doesn't have any ships to get to them to help.
Well, the military's
them.
Got that cool little experimental shuttle.
Oh, that's right,
thing.
Yeah.
That thing's pretty cool. But, you know, you need a rocket. It's not the ship. It's the rocket that pushes it into there. Space. Is what's not ready to go on a moment's notice.
All right, Kara, what's the word this week?
The word this week is comorbidity.
Mm-hmm. It's a happy word.
Say it
it's
again?
A comorbidity. It's
what do you think that means, Jay?
Yeah. It means it's when you and your spouse die at the same time.
Interesting. What do you guys do? You guys feel like what do you think comorbidity means? Unless you know.
I don't know.
I think it goes along with death or something.
Told you. Okay, so comorbidity is actually just existing simultaneously with and often independent from another medical condition, meaning that you have two diagnoses. You have two conditions.
That are going to kill you.
No, not just disease. Yeah. So when I first heard the word, it was in the context of patients that I worked with when I was working for a clinical neuropsychologist back in Texas when I was doing my undergrad work. And many of them had blindness or visual impairment and some sort of neuropsych issue. And so they had comorbid blindness and whatever their diagnosis was there. And I couldn't get past the word when I first heard it that it didn't.
Yeah, it doesn't
I was like,
sound right.
It sounds like they have a dual death diagnosis. Like there's something here. And so. Yeah. You know, to me, comorbidity meant death, but of course, that the real word in medicine for that would be, even though there's no word, comortality.
It's
not a real thing. Morbidity specifically refers to the state of disease. So
comortality is like when you have a heart attack, then you get in a car accident.
Oh, you no. Know, so two things. So, like, on your cause of death, they're like both.
They always have to say one. I'm just saying it'd be.
And or this.
Yeah, there's sometimes a. Things, multiple things happen at once.
Yeah.
Like the guy who falls, jumps off a bridge and somebody shoots him on the way down.
Yes.
Was that
it's
murder?
Rare, but it's,
was that murder?
That happened.
Yeah, right.
When did that happen?
What killed him first? Wasn't that like the famous with Et tu, Brute? Like what's the fatal stab wound?
Yeah.
No? Okay.
No, but you could go to the doctor and be like, okay, I've got incurable cancer and, you know, aneurysm.
No, of course.
Right?
That's comorbidity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, if you have a dual diagnosis, especially in psychiatry, this has become a very popular term, or psychology. If you have a dual diagnosis of, like, depression, anxiety, those are comorbid conditions. Yeah. So the etymology of the word, which was first coined, this is very interesting to me, first coined by epidemiologist A.R. Feinstein. I feel like you're not going to believe me. Here in the U.S., he first came up with the term in the 70s and first published it. It first appeared in the literature in 1985.
Wow.
Yeah, very recent.
It was very recent. But the thing is, it was before I went to medical school.
There you go.
So it's
always
ancient
been
history,
in your
right? It was before.
So it's obviously an amalgamation of co, meaning going, you know, along with, and morbidity, a word from the 1650s meaning diseased. So, but the roots are the same for mortality and morbidity, mort. Right? When we think of mort, old French, Latin, mort means death. And so it was thought of in the 1650s, of course, that these diseases cause death. Like, disease is a death sentence. So so that's really where the word came from. But of course, we were talking about this earlier off audio. Doctors take part in these M&M sessions, right? Which are morbidity, mortality.
Yeah.
Oh.
Where you
morbidity
guys,
and mortality. So things
Gray,
went wrong.
I don't,
yeah.
M&M
so
sessions.
So all doctors are required. This is like an important part of your training, right?
Yeah.
It's everywhere from the residents all the way up to the attendings. And like, how often do you do it? Once a month?
It depends.
Depends on your, where basically the tough ones, right? The people that were lost, the people that maybe something didn't happen the way that you might have wanted. It's how you learn from your mistakes and how you learn, not always from mistakes, but.
Just bad outcomes.
Bad outcomes.
But it is, you know, and different contexts, different specialties, you know, are more brutal. I mean, like
surgery,
like, surgery M&M. If you're like you lose a patient and then you're a resident or something, and then you are grilled. I mean, they will destroy you.
Yeah.
But the idea is that you're going to learn how not to make that mistake again. But sometimes it's also all going over statistics. Like, oh, we had 3 aspirations on the wards this month, meaning 3 patients choked and got a lung infection. Got to get that number down. You know, how do we do that? What are we doing? Everything that we can to do that. It's very important. I do want to point out, though, you know, that the strict definition you gave, while true, is not how we typically use the word in practice.
Well, let me see. And what I had said specifically was existing simultaneously with and often independent from another medical condition.
Yeah. So right. But there's no kind of point in saying you have 2 diseases, having a word for that. We use it when there's a relationship between the 2 diseases that we want to focus on. So, like, for example, I see patients with migraine who have a sleep disorder. And we say those are comorbid. It's not just that you have both at the same time. The migraines worsen your sleep disorder, and your sleep disorder worsens the migraines. They're playing off of each other. So they're comorbid. So that's where we kind of use it that way, because otherwise it's kind of a pointless term.
It's like you have a cold and you have diabetes. Yeah. Like, who cares? But it's interesting that you said that, because
that's sick
in the context that I first heard of the word was when I was working with the clinical neuropsychologist. Like I said, he worked with these patients who were in the blind population or visually impaired population who also had neurological disorders. Very uncommon that they would have, like, retinopathy of prematurity. Yeah. And of course, the retina, everywhere from the retina back is central nervous system. Like, we don't often think about that, but it's the same kind of system, right? There's so much kind of play between the brain and the visual system. And
the retina is really an outgrowth of the nervous system.
Yeah, these are neurons in the retina, you know? Yeah. They kind of follow a lot of central nervous system rules, as it were. So it was not uncommon that you would have visual impairments that directly related to brain, you know, a premature baby who doesn't ever develop their retina appropriately also has some other things that are probably going wrong in their brain. So it's interesting.
Okay. Evan, you are going to handle science or fiction.
Yes, I am.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, Steve normally comes up with 3 items. 2 are true and 1 is false. And it's up to the rogues to figure out which one is the fake. All right, there is a theme. So the theme this science or fiction is the word con, okay? Because we are at Dragon Con.
Con.
Oh, that's the winner.
Not K-Agent. Well, there are several definitions of the word con, and I'm going to actually touch on a couple of these. There are 3 items, okay? And there's 3 different cons in each of these. Okay, number 1. According to a recent study, pornography use by married people has a greater negative impact on marriages of those considered more religious compared to less religious people. And con there being a greater negative impact. Con meaning negative. Number 2. Infamous con man Victor Lustig, most noted for being a master counterfeiter in the early 20th century, traveled to Paris in 1925 and sold the Eiffel Tower to scrap metal dealers at a time when the tower was being seriously considered for demolition. And, of course, con artist is the one there. Number 3. The subtitle of the movie Star Trek II was called The Vengeance of Khan because Star Wars' Episode 6 working subtitle at the time was The Revenge of the Jedi. Out of deference, the Star Trek producers changed the subtitle to The Wrath of Khan. And, of course, con. Yes, we did. So, Ian is our guest. Oh, we're going to poll the audience first to see who thinks they know which one is fiction. So we want to do it with a single clap. Okay. I'll repeat the first one again. According to a recent study, pornography use by married people has a greater negative impact on marriages of those considered more religious compared to less religious people.
Can I ask for clarification on here?
You can when it's your turn. We're going to hold the audience first. Though. If you think number 1 about pornography use is the fiction, clap. 1 clap. If you think the second one about Victor Lustig, the con man, is the fiction, clap. And if you think the third one about the Wrath of Khan is the fiction, clap.
So okay. Even across the board.
Maybe a little less for Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
Ian, you're first, so you can go ahead and read and tell us what you think.
But question, when it says pornography used by married people, is that meaning individually
or
used?
Exactly.
Like I'm over here in the corner when you're sleeping, or is it used like as a marital aid, like we watch porno together?
Let's see, is there a way to clarify for that?
Probably not.
Pornography used by married people. It's individual. Obviously it's individual, but it's both male and female.
Okay. All right, so it's not the couple watching.
So it's not saying like as a marital age, it fails more often. Yeah.
Right. Gosh, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm only, because I have no idea, I'm only going to go with this for the theme. I'm going to say number three.
Okay, so number three, you think The Wrath of Khan is the fiction?
Yes. I actually don't think that, but I'm going to go with that one. I have no idea.
The one about pornography is interesting because you're thinking, I'm thinking here, if it's more harmful for a religious couple, someone in a religious couple to use pornography for the marriage, you know, why would that be? And I can't make a connection in my head of why it would be worse. I mean, other than that person might having more innate guilt about it. I don't know.
Unless
I'm missing something. So I don't know about that. The second one about Victor Lustig selling the Eiffel Tower. Interesting. I'm pretty damn sure that happened or something very similar to that happened. So I'm going to think that one right out of the gate is science. And this last one about the Star Trek changing the title of their movie to accommodate Star Wars is basically the item at its essence. I love that idea. I think it's cool. I like that my two brands are commingling in a nice way. But I don't believe that it happened. I think I would have heard of that. I think I absolutely would have heard of that. So I'm going to say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Khan's the fiction for Jay.
All right. The the pornography one, I actually read this item. But I didn't read that detail. So,
because you didn't dig deep enough.
Yeah, no, it's true. No, you know, what I read was that it's bad. When couples start to use pornography, it increases the risk of them getting a divorce. Mm-hmm. But I didn't read about anything to do with subgroups and comparisons. So I don't know if that's correct. It could be the opposite, that there's a little bit of protective effect from being religious. I don't know. That could go either way. The one about the Eiffel Tower sounds vaguely familiar. I don't know that one, but it's plausible. Yeah. I've never heard the one about the Wrath of Khan and the Vengeance of Khan. It's interesting. It's an interesting idea, that they would do that. I don't know if I should say that's the fiction because I never heard of it before. That I could certainly see that little obscurity, you know, bypassing my attention. I'm going to say the one with the pornography is the fiction. I think that you flipped a detail in there. I think that's probably what happened.
Kara.
I was leaning towards something similar to what Steve was saying because it almost seems like at its face value, like emotionally my reaction is obviously religious people, when they find out that their partner is like beating off behind closed doors, they're going to lose.
Wait, that is, you see right there.
Yeah, that's
you're
what
you're being
it is.
Prejudiced because that means a guy is doing it, not a woman.
Yeah.
See what she did? More likely.
See what she did? You're right. You're right. Okay, we admit you're right.
What percentage is actually made for women versus made for men? There's some.
All there.
Yeah, it's all there. I would assume that. I feel like at face value, right, religious people would be more offended by that. It would be more of an accosting their marriage.
You're saying
more.
Like when the wife finds out, then that's what.
Of course.
Oh, I didn't think it seemed too terrible.
No, the other interpretation
or just
is
that the marriage is suffering.
That the pornography is just a marker for the marriage suffering.
For the marriage
that they're turning
apart
to pornography because they're not getting it in the bedroom.
Yeah, that either way, that there's. So there is a correlation between marriages failing and pornography use.
Yeah.
But is the question, is there a higher correlation if and when the couples have religious faith? I would think it would be easy to say, obviously, because it would be more of an insult to them because there's like something intrinsically immoral about pornography in many religions. But at the same time, you mentioned this idea that it could be protective. Like maybe if it's a religious couple, they find out, they pray together, they get, you know, redemption for it, and then it's easier for them to get over it. Where if I was like, ah, crap, I just found out, you know, my boyfriend's jerking off every night and he's not satisfied, whatever. Although I think it can be a good marital aid. The other two, I literally, like, I have never heard of either of these things. Victor Lustig, sure, I don't know. Vengeance of Kong. Like, I Star Wars, know anything about Star Wars. Which one is the... No, I'm kidding. But let's see.
Which is the one with the lightsabers.
And the blaster and the phaser.
I watched all seven of them.
McLavin.
So I'm going to actually GWS, which I never get to say.
When are you going to choose?
I know. And I'm going to say the pornography one might be a little bit of a bait and switch. Like, it's deeper than my gut reaction to it.
Okay.
Bob.
Come on, Bob.
I'm not going to go on. But the Star Trek Wrath of Khan thing, I think that's right. I think I've read that.
Don't say that.
I could be confusing with something else, but I bet $10 on it. The Lustig one sounds kind of reasonable. If they were really thinking of trashing it,
sounds ridiculous to me. But
the porn one, though, I think that sounds like it's easy to flip something. So I kind of agree with those guys. So I'll say porn fiction.
Okay, let's see if it had an influence on the audience. If you think still the pornography one is the fiction, give us a clap. If you think Mr. Lustig, the sale of the Eiffel Tower is the fiction, give us a clap.
Oh.
It's like a half of one clap.
Got it.
How was the, yeah, it was one clap.
And if you think The Wrath of Khan is the fiction, give us a clap. Okay, so one and three, certainly. Let's start with two. Infamous con man Victor Lustig, most noted for being a master counterfeiter in the early 20th century, traveled to Paris in 1925 and sold the Eiffel Tower to scrap metal dealers at a time when the tower was being seriously considered for demolition. None of the rogues, or our guest, thought that this one is fiction, and this one is science. Yes.
I read that. Well
done. Yeah, it sounds like sure did. Familiar. I think I heard that at some point.
He built $70,000 out of scrap metal dealers as a down payment, because it is true. The Eiffel Tower was considered to be dilapidated for its time and really was under consideration for tearing it down.
So he just convinced these people that he had some sort of authority over what happens to
that's,
the metal.
That's exactly what he did. He traveled to Paris.
He brokered the metal. Yeah.
And he kept it. He kept it all on the very hush hush as much as possible, obviously, and was playing them, you know, to try to, you know, as a secret thing, so that he could try to give this guy the best possible deal. And he came to an agreement with them, and they wound up giving him a payment of $20,000 and another payment of $50,000 in about a week. And then he fled. And then he left the country.
What was the year?
1925.
Well, there's
a lot of money.
A lot of money back then.
Did they catch up with it? That's like, because the joke is, like, I got a bridge I want to sell you. You know what I mean?
I got a Eiffel Tower
I want to sell you.
And I was researching this. I was considering going with the bridge one in its place, but I thought this one would be a little more interesting. And yes, he did get away with it. The people who gave him the $70,000 did not pursue him because it was too embarrassing.
Which is what con artists count on.
Yeah, that's right.
Do we all know about this now?
Because he was eventually
bragged.
Yeah, he bragged.
He was the Eiffel Tower.
He was eventually caught in New York several years later because of his counterfeiting activities, and this all came out as a result.
He was a hell of a con artist, that guy.
Yeah,
he was a grifter.
His counterfeiting thing was this. It was called the money box. So what he would do is he would counterfeit $100 bills and stuff a bunch in this box. And he would go on these luxury cruise ships and, you know, wine and dine with the wealthy people. And he'd say, here, you know, I've kind of got this thing. He'd take a real $100 bill, put it in there. And while the chemical processing is going on, an hour later, a couple of other $100 bills, which looked authentic, would come out. And he would repeat this over and over the course of the trip. And by the end of it, he would wind up selling the money box to whomever would basically give him $20,000 or $30,000. And he did this several times. He sold several money boxes by doing it.
They thought it duplicated money?
Yes.
Counterfeiting?
Oh, my God. He was making more con artists.
But was he having them give him $100 bills to put in there to test it out, too?
Real $100 bill to go in, but fake ones, but replicants were coming out.
The guy's a genius.
he had a finesse about it. He was known as, like, the dapper con man. He was the gentleman, in a sense. So he was able to really, really pull it off. Awesome. All right, let's go back to let's go to number one. According to a recent study of pornography, use by married people has a greater negative impact on marriages of those considered more religious compared to less religious people. And Bob and Kara and Steve, you all believe that this one is the fiction.
Oh, he looks so happy. Oh, no.
Too cocky.
This one is the fiction.
Yes!
It is the fiction. Steve, exactly correct. I did flip that around.
Yeah.
So people who are less religious, it was they were more apt to get divorced.
You think that was because of the repentance component?
I think also religious people have a stigma about getting divorced.
That's true. Yeah, right. They're going to do more to try and avoid it.
That's not nice.
And by the way, religious people is defined according to this study as you're religious if you attend religious services once a week or more.
Oh, and
anything,
that's pretty religious.
Anything less than that was considered less than religious. And overall, the increase went up, doubled. You're 6% for the baseline who had no pornography either in the couple of years that they interviewed the people, and then a few years later that they interviewed them again. If there was no pornography use, the divorce rate was 6%. But for those who started with no pornography and then introduced pornography over the couple of years and then tested them again, it doubled 12%.
I see. So it was like an increase in the use of pornography.
Yeah. Increase in the use of pornography.
If they already used pornography when they
got
together.
Yeah, it was baseline use,
That means when you start a relationship, start with pornography.
Yes.
That's the takeaway.
Really, that's what I was thinking. I was like, who doesn't look at porn?
Incorporate it right
so
from the beginning.
I'm still confused, though. Like, I really wonder if what that means, if that means individually or together, because those are two completely different things. I mean, they really are. Because I know people. Oh, is it separately? Okay.
I think this is more like pornography as an indicator that the marriage is failing, not pornography as a tool to help save a marriage.
See, that's what I thought. That's what I thought too.
Like,
it's starting to fail. Let's introduce pornography.
I'm never getting laid, so I'm just gonna go jerk off every night.
Yep. And so that was deep in the article that there is like the second to last paragraph.
Go deep enough is what you're saying. Penetrate a little bit further into that article.
But Evan, the good news is he got it in the end. At least I'm trying, Joel.
Oh, God, your daughter looks so mortified right now.
And, of course, this means the subtitle of the movie Star Trek II was called The Vengeance of Khan because Star Wars Episode VI working subtitle at the time was Revenge of the Jedi. Out of deference, the Star Trek producers changed the subtitle to Wrath of Khan.
How did I not hear this?
This is
you guys
true.
Didn't hear that?
And I did go to several sources to verify that because it didn't sound right to me at first. This I had never heard of this before myself.
Wow.
But I did verify that this is in fact
true.
Those
are bad
nerds. That one is science. Good job, Bob, Kara, and Steve, Jay, and Ian. Thank you for playing.
Next time.
Thank you, audience. You did well.
Audience did a good job.
Good job.
That was good. Okay, so we have time for some questions. So throw some questions out at us. Wait, hang on.
With the dogs and the MRI, you're talking about training like. Spending hundreds of hours to train these dogs to sit still, and like with the kids too, why not just like strap them down? Like, is there a reason you can't just like, you know, screw them in place or something?
No, they are strapped down. So the dog has to, they train it to lay its head on these foam blocks, and then there's a coil, and they strap the coil to its head. But it, let's say this dog's strapped in. If he does this, his brain moves, and the data's not usable. If he does this, the data's not usable. So they are strapped in, but they have to be, like, mindful and calm. Like, they'll see water dripping down, like, from its eye or something dripping down, and he'll want to lick it, and he has, like, the presence of mind not to lick the water away off of his face. Like, these are very well-trained dogs.
They hit just, like, clockwork orange screws, like, straight to their skulls.
Because even
not with an fMRI.
Trying to move would be a problem.
With other studies, sure. Like, you'll see studies with monkeys and with other types of paradigms where they will, like, screw them in place in order to do maybe some, like, robotic studies with limbs and things like that. But specifically with the kind of imaging technology, if you move it all, they can't get a good read.
All right, Evan, close us out with a quote.
Common sense is the best distributed commodity in the world, for every man is convinced that he is well supplied with it. René Descartes. Very enlightenment. Yes, indeed. Well said, Renee. We overestimate our own sense of common sense. Too often.
Yeah, there's a lot of things like that. Everyone thinks they're a good driver. Everyone thinks they're good in bed.
And they're funny.
Damn right.
Everyone thinks they're funny. Right?
Hilarious,
right?
Some of us.
That's true, for sure.
And most people are wrong.
Yeah, for sure. And you guys saw that incredible study that compared like Asian students to American students in terms of how they felt they did on some sort of an exam, like what percentile they thought they were in. And it was something insane. Like all the American students thought that they were in the 90th percentile, which is physically impossible, right?
Yeah,
That's the Dunning-Kruger.
There you go. And it's actually not as severe apparently in Asian countries when it comes to certain types of tests.
So Dunning-Kruger has a cultural element to it?
Seems like it.
Well, yeah. All right. Well, thank you all for joining us in our live audience. Ian, thanks for joining us on the
SGP. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Tell us where people can see you, get your stuff.
Well, if you know, I have a an hour TV special called Critical in Thinking that you can watch on Hulu or Amazon or anywhere that you can VOD download. And then I'm taping my second one called Extraordinary in October. And we'll see. I can't exactly say where that's going, but it'll be the early 2017 that'll be available.
Cool. Awesome. Cool. Great. Yeah. Again, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.